Welcome to Rights Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Joyce Starr. Among my books, I'm also the author of Defend Your Condo and Homeowner Rights and publisher of the first Homeowner's Defense Kit for condo owners and HOA members. You can find our books through the Rights Radio store and at starpublications.com. That's star with two R's and publications with an S.com. The Homeowner's Defense Kit Trilogy, which includes my book, is the first link on the left. And we also offer telephone consultations on condo board, HOA board, and homeowner rights problems. Our topic today, protecting shareholder rights through civil prosecutorial litigation. The majority of Americans believe that the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, protects shareholder rights by prosecuting companies that violate those rights. While the SEC does launch civil litigation in defense of shareholder rights, its resources are extremely limited. The SEC therefore relies on private law firms to supplement such efforts. What are the red flags? How does a leading law firm become involved in a particular case? Our guest explains the process. He also reveals shocking details of the Cybernaut case recently won by his law firm, Cohn Milstein, where he was the lead associate attorney. This scandal spanned three continents and included extramarital affairs, hookers, and the purchase of expensive jewelry with corporate funds. Jason M. Leviton, an associate of Cohn Milstein, joined the firm in 2004 as a member of the Securities Fraud Investor Protection Practice Group, and prior to joining Cohn Milstein, he was a securities class action attorney with another well-known securities class action firm. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you, Dr. Starr. How are you today?
It's wonderful to have you on the program.
Great. I appreciate you inviting me.
Thank you. Jason, can you please share some of your impressive background with our listeners?
Sure. I grew up in Seattle, went to college at Gonzaga University. I also attended the Gonzaga School of Law. Prior to there, I grew up, like I said, in Seattle. After law school, I attended the Georgetown University Law Center, received a Master's of Laws in Securities and Financial Regulations.
And what did you do after that? How did you get into the entire legal arena with this particular law firm?
Well, as you said, I first started with another well-known law firm in Florida as a securities attorney there, and then wanted to get back to D.C., Cohen, Milstein, Housefield, and Toll, where I am employed now, had an excellent reputation, great attorneys. They did exactly the type of high-stakes legal actions that I was looking to do and made this change.
Well, that's wonderful, and it's such an important topic in light of how terrified people are of losing their life savings, and you're one of the good guys, and your firm is as well.
Now, we certainly try to be.
And I think you succeed. Jason, can you talk about the government's role? I mentioned that we have an impression of the SEC, but perhaps it's not entirely correct. How does the government get involved in protecting shareholder rights?
Well, there's two basic ways that the government gets involved in these types of actions. The first is through the Securities and Exchange Commission. The Securities and Exchange Commission, or the SEC, regulates civilly the securities laws. That is, they protect shareholders by requiring companies to make periodic filings, both on a quarterly basis and a yearly basis, and also if a material event occurs in the company. They also can bring enforcement actions, and that is civil litigation through the courts to actually stop people or enjoin them from committing these violations once one has occurred. The second way is through the Department of Justice, or the U.S. Attorney's Office. They can bring criminal actions against the same types of individuals. For example, in the Enron case, they can work together, along with private firms. In a case like Enron, or like Cybernaut that we will be speaking about shortly, the SEC launches a case civilly against them. The U.S. Attorney's Office and the Department of Justice follow suit, bring criminal charges, and then civil actions, such as the one brought by my law firm, can join in after.
Well, how does a law firm like yours become alerted to the fact that there's a growing problem within the company?
Well, we do several things. I can tell you how my law firm works. We watch the securities markets extremely closely. We watch stocks and bonds. We want to know, you know, who is making disclosures and what those disclosures are. We watch the stock price. You know, if a stock price jumps, you know, by 20 or 30% in a day, that's something we'd like to know. If a stock price drops 20 or 30% in a day, that is something we watch. There are also websites devoted to watching shareholder action. If another law firm brings a case, we look at that case and decide if we believe it is strong. I can tell you that every single securities, federal securities class action that is brought, we analyze. We have a team of attorneys, which includes myself, several outstanding partners at my firm, a Wall Street trained analyst who analyzes each and every case that is filed, so that we can go to our clients, both institutional and individual, and alert them to possible actions.
This is amazing, because it would suggest that rather than billing for time, you're actually investing your time and your research without billing, on the basis that there will be people who need to be protected down the line.
That's absolutely true. We do not generally bill on an hourly rate, and we almost never collect a penny if we lose a case. So we are very careful about which actions we bring, and we look at the cases. We decide if we believe that shareholders have a remedy. If they do have a remedy, it's something else we look at to determine if it is a civil remedy that we can do, if the SEC is bringing it, or if the DOJ is bringing it. Something that is very important for you and the listeners to realize is, unfortunately, not every wrong has a remedy. There are times where we believe wrongdoing has occurred, but under the federal securities laws, there is just not a remedy. That is not to say necessarily that there is not a remedy through other actions at the state level, through state laws, or as such. But not every action has a feasible federal securities law violation. So we look very, very closely into cases before investing hundreds, if not thousands of hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars into an action.
Doesn't every case, though, I mean, you get so many of these letters in the mail saying that about this case or that, and please let us know if you bought shares or you sold shares, etc. It seems that there is at least that part of it going on, but that is different. Is that somehow in a different arena?
Every law firm looks at a case differently.
Okay.
Again, I can only tell you what my law firm does and what my personal experience is. Before we would send out such a letter, and we do send out those letters, before we would do it, we would analyze the case and make sure that this is a case that we believe a wrong has occurred. Now, that's not to say, again, that none of our cases have been dismissed. That's, of course, untrue. But I can tell you that the majority of our cases have been detailed down to the exact allegations of what we think was said incorrectly or wrongly, why we think that was done incorrectly, and why an investor should be able to recover from a particular defendant.
Can you talk a bit about the mega fraud cases like Enron and WorldCom, Fannie Mae, and the misunderstandings that the public might have about those mega cases?
Absolutely. A mega case is a case in which most of the listeners have probably heard of, as you detailed, the Enron cases, the WorldCom cases, the Global Crossing, the Parmalat, the big cases. Now, interestingly about one of the mega cases is that there are lots and lots of defendants and lots of investors that lost lots of money. And that is absolutely true. And those are the cases you hear about, you know, the Fannie Mae, the case that is in the Wall Street Journal all the time. You know, again, Parmalat, a case that is in the news all the time. Those cases are extremely important cases because you're talking about individuals and entities, that being institutional investors, that lost millions, if not billions of dollars, or even tens of billions of dollars in just a few weeks because of an alleged fraud. What you see less of in the mega cases is that the individual itself is actually leading the case. Most of those cases are led by very large, very sophisticated institutions. For example, in a case like Enron, was led by the California Public Retirement System. Yes, of course, CalPERS, as it is known as, is comprised of individual investors. But in order to really lead that litigation, it's going to take an extremely sophisticated investor, like an institution like the California Public Retirement System. The same is true with the Parmalat litigation. Those cases are led by very sophisticated, both foreign and domestic, institutional investors.
But what happens on the inside when one day the head of the fund decides that they're really going to take a very aggressive stance? How does it all unravel or evolve, let us say?
Well, typically what happens is, you know, in a case, again, like a Parmalat or an Enron, you would see what happens to the stock. You would see a company make a disclosure. For example, we are restating our financials for the years 2000 through 2003. Or we are restating our financial statements for the years 2000 and 2003, and we have terminated our CEO and our CFO, that being a chief executive officer or a chief financial officer. You look for those types of disclosures, and then you dig a little deeper. What are they disclosing? Remember, under the federal securities laws, under the 1933 Securities Act, companies are required to basically be open books to their investors. Remember, the investors are the ones that own the companies.
They don't usually open their books, and that's why these scandals happen. They hide it so well.
You know, I can tell you, Enron is a perfect example. Is an extremely complex fraud with a lot of accounting irregularities that you would not have necessarily been able to find prior to announcements by the company itself. That is absolutely true. But in a case like that, you see, trickling out of information. For example, you might see, we are going to restate our financials for 30 days based on inventory issues. Well, then, very sophisticated attorneys and financial analysts get together and say, well, what has happened here? How did they misvalue their inventory? Sometimes it's something that makes a lot of sense. Not every disclosure is fraud. Maybe the standard of gold has dropped in value or has increased in value. If one of those companies owns a lot of gold or needs a lot of gold or metals, for example, that might not necessarily be a fraud. However, sometimes the price of gold, in that example, did not go drastically up or down. So it doesn't make a lot of sense why that would be the reason. If that is the case, you start digging, you go deeper and deeper, you start looking at their financial statements and on conference calls, and you see what insiders have been doing. For example, if an insider, that being a chief executive officer or a chief financial officer, has continually been buying the company's shares throughout the class period, that might make it less likely that they knew that these accounting shenanigans had occurred. However, if you see that the company insider has been selling lots and lots of shares, millions of dollars worth of shares, that could lead you to a different conclusion. If you see, five or six of the company's key officers having sold hundreds, if not thousands, of shares of stock shortly before a disclosure that caused the stock price to drop, that would be something that a securities attorney and a financial analyst would find very helpful in getting to their conclusion that a possible fraud has occurred.
What concerns me about what you say is that the institutions have the manpower to be on top of that, and even they are taken by surprise. So what happens to the poor individual investor who may own that stock outright, perhaps not even as part of a fund? I know I owned shares in Enron at the time and haven't a clue. You're not looking at your portfolio every day. You're certainly not on top of every announcement. And even if you are, you can't interpret them.
I can tell you this. What I have told some very sophisticated individuals and entities that I have worked with, is that that's what fraud is. Fraud is tricking the intelligent individual or institution into believing one thing while another is true. Just a simple lie isn't going to fool somebody like the California Public Retirement System or the Arizona State Retirement System or the Connecticut Retirement System. Those institutions have very sophisticated brokers, very sophisticated accounting systems, and they can catch those types of things. But that's what fraud does. Fraud is a way to make everything look rosy, while in reality, a very different view actually exists.
And really terrifying for the individual. Perhaps part of the red flag solution is not to be overly invested in individual stocks, because you can't interpret what you're hearing. You're only one person.
Well, I can tell you, I am not a stockbroker. And I would certainly tell you and anybody listening out there, if they have any questions about particular stock options, to definitely consult their broker or to do their research. I have never, and I would never, give somebody advice on how to invest. I can tell you that I am very well diversified, and that I personally would not put everything I have, hopefully, in one particular company's stock, just in case something like this occurs. But I can tell you that some very intelligent people might disagree with that position.
Or they might have done the opposite for a number of reasons, not the least of which is hoping for a home run.
Absolutely.
Typically. Or believing in Enron so firmly that it seemed like a fortress.
But, you know, Enron, is a perfect example of a case where people thought that that company was extremely safe. That was what we call their hedge investment. Their feeling was, well, if everything else goes down, at least I have this one very safe investment, which is what caused the losses in the hundreds of millions of dollar range. But again, you know, you and anybody listening should not feel disappointed in themselves when they get taken for fraud. It's not their fault. Fraud occurs because some very sophisticated business people work very hard to cover something up that is almost impossible to detect.
Isn't it a pity that they didn't work just as hard to make their companies a success?
You know, it's true. And very interestingly, defendants will sometimes argue that to a court, that they say, look, if they would have looked harder, if they would have looked at this website or that website, you know, of the billions of websites that are out there, well, if they happened to look here or here, you know, they would have seen, you know, this particular disclosure. And that's what companies do when they commit fraud. You know, they work very hard to figure out a way that you cannot detect it, even if you're really looking.
In other words, they cover their tracks before the event. They start putting out tiny little disclosures, which they know that if they're caught, they can then come back and say, but we said this.
You know, I consider myself a very sophisticated attorney, and I can guarantee you that I work at one of the top plaintiffs firms in the country. And I can also tell you that defendants in cases that I have litigated and cases that I have not litigated have very sophisticated counsel and very good counsel. And I would never, accuse an attorney at a defense firm to trying to cover things up. I don't think they do that. I think they follow the law. I think they just have a different view of the law than I would. I believe that the spirit of the law is for full disclosure, and that is full and honest disclosure. Now, it is possible that you can make disclosures according to the Securities Act, both the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, and not be in violation of the law. However, not be quite as forthright as I would hope a company would be.
As you hope it would be.
Absolutely.
The key words here. Let's talk for a while now, because it's so fascinating, about the Cybernaut case.
Okay.
I imagine that most of our listeners are not familiar with Cybernaut, but it easily could be a household word because of what was involved. And you were part of the action here, and played an important role, and I'd like you to tell our listeners a bit about it.
Okay, the Zybernaut case is a very interesting case. Zybernaut, the company, which is now that went through the public company, went through bankruptcy proceedings. The complaint alleged in Zybernaut that several individuals basically used company funds for their personal entertainment expenses. For example, the complaint alleged that the company CEO was, you know, making extravagant trips to China, was spending money on his girlfriend, was, you know, buying her jewelry, staying at first-class resorts, spending money on prostitutes. It was a very interesting case. Now, remember, when a company is spending that money, that is the investor's money. So our argument in that case was that that was fraud because the company was not disclosing the true uses of that money. When the company was saying that they were trying to cut costs, they had an obligation, the complaint alleged, to also disclose that they were spending substantial amounts of money on things that were not necessarily directly related to the company.
Let's talk a bit about what Zybernaut did. What was the product? Can you explain that?
Yes, Zybernaut's product was wearable mobile computers. And I can tell you, and I should tell you, that Zybernaut, the company, is still in existence. It's just no longer a publicly traded company. And what they did is they basically had these computers that you could wear, and that very large companies purchased. Companies like CSX Railroad, you know, purchased these. You know, airlines, you know, the military. And you basically, it almost looks like a vest, or at least it did back when the case began. It was a vest with pieces of a computer basically on them that went to a headset. And the argument was, at least the company proclaimed, that these would change the way that people could use computers because they were wearable and they were easily mobile.
But what happened? Why weren't they producing them in the numbers that they said they were? What led these people, and it was, by the way, the president and the vice president, I believe, or the chairman and the vice president. Can you tell us about the officers who perpetuated these crimes?
Well, what I can tell you is that the complaint alleges, again, you know, we have settled the case, and that is obviously public information. The defendants have never admitted wrongdoing, and I'm not here to tell you my position on what I think did or did not happen. What I can tell you is what the complaint alleged.
Okay.
And the complaint alleged that the CEO of the company and another high-ranking individual, which happened to be his brother, were basically touting the stock and telling a bunch of individuals that it was an extremely wise investment and that they were growing exponentially. Now, they never claimed to have actually turned a profit. That's what's very interesting about the case. They fully admitted that they had that their expenses had outweighed their assets, or what they had brought in, their revenue, throughout the life of the company. But they also had made people believe that that was going, or at least the complaint alleges, that they were trying to get people to believe that that was not going to be the case for good, and that they eventually were going to be signing the big contracts. And the other interesting thing about Zybernaut, the company and a few of the officers and the directors of the company, is that the government has now alleged in an indictment in the Eastern District of New York that their actions were criminal, both the actions I have discussed, but actually several other instances that the government believes they should have disclosed. Now, I can tell you that that indictment is currently pending. They are obviously innocent until proven guilty. I know several of their attorneys, and they are highly decorated, absolutely incredibly detailed attorneys, and they will be putting on a very vigorous defense. I would be surprised if anything, but that was the actual case.
And yet, the record is clear. The extramarital affairs, the hookers, the international trips, the jewelry, all that has been documented.
We certainly alleged that in our complaint. We had confidential witnesses that told us those things were absolutely correct.
On three continents, I believe, or at least two.
Certainly here and in Asia.
Okay.
Those were the allegations. It is a very interesting case, you know, because of the international presence of what was occurring. You know, but some of that stuff, you know, you should also be aware, isn't necessarily illegal. You know, while we might all have our own views on an extramarital affair, that doesn't necessarily mean it's illegal, nor does it mean it's securities fraud. What we alleged was securities fraud was that he was purchasing very expensive gifts for this individual using company funds. If he had, or if we were unable to allege that he was purchasing these tools and these prostitutes and massage parlors and expensive shoes for his mistress and was using his own funds to do that, we would not have had a securities fraud claim based on those actions. Now, there were other actions that maybe we could have alleged, but not necessarily a securities fraud based solely on purchasing a prostitute using his own money.
But then why did the company go down, basically, other than those extraordinary expenses? Obviously, they weren't making money in the first place, or at least not enough, yet they had these major contracts. So why did it go down?
Well, again, the complaint alleges that their expenses just were too much for their revenue stream and that they were unable, you know, to pay for their expenses. Now, remember, they also were running a legitimate business here. You know, they were making wearable mobile computers, and they had very high research and development costs. So many of their costs were absolutely legitimate. But there were a material amount, or the complaint alleged, that there were a material amount of expenses that should have been disclosed. I think the bigger problem is, once it was determined, their auditor was Grant Thornton. And when Grant Thornton basically refused to certify their financial statements, and that went public, now if they should have or not is basically irrelevant, you know, and that's something that Zybernaut, the company itself, will likely be, you know, arguing, people stopped purchasing the stock. And without that revenue stream coming in of purchasing stock, without that capital coming in, they were just unable to pay for both the legitimate and illegitimate parts of the company. That's what the
company. So it all revolved around one action of the auditor, basically.
Well, you know, the auditors are gatekeepers. You know, the auditors and the accountants and the lawyers, you know, we're all gatekeepers. And that's an auditor's job. You know, in a way, that was exactly what Grant Thornton, assuming that they really, you know, did discover what they had disclosed, you know, that's their requirement. You know, they are obligated to go public and to not certify financials that they do not believe are incorrect. And clearly, based on the press releases and the allegations by Grant Thornton, they did not believe that they could, in good faith, certify those financial statements.
So here comes the auditor, and he issues a press release. The company, the auditor's company, issues a press release. Is that right?
Well, the auditor can do it in several different ways. Really, what they can do is they can refuse. What one thing I also want to stress, there are many, many, many good people at Zybernaut that did absolutely nothing wrong. You know, both high-level, mid-level, and low-level employees were taken just like every individual investor and institutional investor. These were good people trying to do their jobs, and they were deceived as well. And basically what happened was once the auditor refused to certify the financial statements, those good people, you know, including many individuals on the board of directors, said, wait a minute, what's going on, and looked into the allegations and came to their own conclusion. And many of those conclusions seemed in line with what the auditors had been saying and what plaintiffs ended up alleging.
But that's the morning after. That's really where I was heading with this, is the moment that that auditor makes his conclusion public, it's too late for the public. The public can't get out fast enough. The stock will have already dropped in the morning, or perhaps, you know, not exist at all. It could go down to 1 cent. And Zybernaut got there pretty quickly, I believe. So how does the public defend itself, the stockholder?
Well, you do a few things. You know, you first want to make sure that a company is very well managed. You know, is this a company that has been sued 10 times, you know, for securities fraud? You know, is the company a company in which one of the things my law firm is doing very, looking into very closely now is what is the makeup of the board of directors? Mm-hmm. You know, is every member of the board of director, you know, somehow associated with the company, or are they outside and independent? A company that's board of directors is comprised of its CEO, its CFO, its treasurer, its secretary, and, you know, the CEO's wife or daughter and some other close friends, I would be a little more skeptical. Whereas if a company's board of directors included very prominent individuals from the community, it probably makes it less likely that these things occur. Now, that's not to say that they won't occur. You know, these negative things can be covered up from them, too. But that's certainly something that an individual or an entity certainly should be looking at. And you should also be looking at, you know, as you had said earlier, you know, institutional investors are extremely sophisticated. You know, in some stocks, they're almost exclusively held by institutional investors. Whereas on other stocks, almost no institutions hold those stocks. A company that, you know, is you know, and each of those things should probably tell you something.
Well,
you
if the stock is trading for less than $5, an institution, or even perhaps more, an institution can't own it. Isn't that right?
You know, there are different requirements for, you know, institutional participation and what would make an institution buy or sell a stock. As I said, I am not a stockbroker. I'm the last person to give somebody advice on what type of stock to buy. But I guess my conclusion is to do your research. And you still might get taken, but it will give you some protection.
Which would argue against fast trading and jumping in to a stock you don't know.
Again, I couldn't and I wouldn't give any advice regarding trading stocks. I've lost more money trading stocks than about anybody, so I would be the worst person to talk about that. But I can tell you that my law firm believes, and I believe personally, that deterrence works. The reason we have the SEC and the reason we have the DOJ and the reason law firms like mine exist is to deter this conduct from occurring again. And I believe when we bring a lawsuit against company ABC Inc., that will deter law firm XYZ from committing fraud because they see what we can do. They know that we're good, we're well capitalized, we can spend the money we need to uncover these frauds. You know, we will spend what's necessary to protect the individuals and the entities, and we will do everything in our power to try to recoup not only their money, but also to deter other companies from doing these things again. One of the things that my law firm has really started to do now is also look at corporate governance reforms. You know, if you have a company that you sue and, you know, you can get money back, that's one thing. But institutional holders are long-term shareholders, and they don't necessarily want to get out of the stock. So we try to look at issues that would help those individuals and those entities from getting caught by the same company again. Again, these corporate governance reforms can involve, you know, having more accounting experience on the board of directors. It could be to slow down insider sales of stock. It could include, you know, the chief legal officer reviewing stock sales. It can be lots of different things. You know, another committee, you know, designed to deter these types of actions. You know, additional oversight. There's lots of different things, and it's all company specific. There would be no way for me to say in every case, we try to get the following corporate governance reforms. However, corporate governance reforms are essential to most cases where we believe the wrongdoing is ripe to occur again or not ripe to occur. You know, sometimes it's one bad actor that did something and there really is no need to reform their corporate governance structure.
How do you go about that, though? Obviously, again, you're not being paid by anybody to put forward those recommendations or to put the manpower behind moving them forward. How do you move that process and put it in place?
You know, that's actually a very good point. We generally get paid, the law firm, that being us or another plaintiff's law firm that does what we do, based on the percentage, based on a percentage of the overall settlement. If this case settles for $1 million or $100 million, we will generally receive a percentage of that settlement. So how do you value a corporate governance reform? You know, if I can get a company to agree to include an additional member of the board that is independent, how do I get paid from that? And the basic answer is, I might not. But I have a professional obligation and a moral obligation, to be quite honest with you, to not only, you know, protect shareholders that have been injured, but to do my job at the best as I can, to give my shareholders and the class, you know, the most zealous representation possible. And sometimes that zealousy leads to corporate governance reforms. If we think it is helpful, we will certainly do it. Remember, we represent some extremely large institutions, and our institutions are long-term shareholders. They are not generally day traders. You know, they are institutions that like a particular stock and want to stay in the stock. And the way we can protect them from being, from losing money in this stock again is to implementing these corporate governance reforms. And we believe those are extremely important, and we will continue to do it.
I've never heard of a law firm that builds its business on not billing for its billable hours. And having been in the government and seen these types of departments and divisions that are very aggressive, and having been in the think tank world, again, very aggressive investigators on one issue or another, it seems to me that you're operating in this sphere almost as a quasi-government agency and think tank at the same time.
You know, I can tell you, I kind of think of my job as almost a quasi-governmental entity. I can tell you that before working at my first law firm, when I was at Georgetown, I actually worked for the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I come to a case now in the private sector with the same mindset that I came to at the government. It is, how can I help investors? And sometimes helping investors means being able to recoup money, and sometimes it is to implement corporate governance reforms, and sometimes it is both. I can tell you outright that there are many cases, and maybe even a majority of cases, where a corporate governance reform won't help. You know, everything was fine. There was just a misdeed or an alleged misdeed. And, you know, putting another independent director on the board isn't going to be able to solve that problem. But I can also tell you that there are several cases where corporate governance reforms might be the only legitimate remedy. You know, maybe there isn't, you know, a monetary penalty or not a very large monetary penalty, but if I can keep it from happening again, that is certainly something I can look at. I can tell you that my law firm, I think, is unique. We look in every case into potential corporate governance reforms, and if we can, you know, come up with a way that we believe will help both current and future shareholders, we will absolutely look into those things and try to get those into any settlement.
I think it gives me a great deal of comfort to know that you're out there and that your law firm is out there. I think anybody listening would be quite shocked to hear this, a different point of view entirely, and it is a level of comfort. So thank you for that.
Not a problem.
I wanted to ask you, how long does it take to prosecute this type of case, I mean, legally speaking?
Well, that is a very complicated question, or it's at least a question that I can't give a solid answer to.
Okay.
These cases can range anywhere from 6 months to, you know, 6 years to even longer. You know, I've been involved in cases that didn't last that long, and I've also been involved with cases that lasted several years.
How long did Cybernaut take?
Well, Cybernaut, the alleged fraud, at least the complaint in what we call the class period, that is the time of wrongdoing, was about 3 years. We were able to reach a settlement in principle, and don't quote me on the numbers, somewhere around 07. So, you know, 2.5 years, 2 years, 3 years.
That's good. And it wasn't overturned.
You know, certainly not yet. Again, you know, we were working with very reasonable defense attorneys,
mm-hmm.
and we were able to sit down and come up to a resolution in a way that we all believe was extremely favorable. You know, I can tell you that my law firm believes the settlement was fair, and I think the defendants believed the settlement was fair.
Including the chief executive officer who had taken the company into bankruptcy?
You know, I've never spoken with him, to be honest with you, so I don't know his position. But I know that, you know, we were able to reach a resolution, and a resolution takes two parties. You know, even if I'm trying to settle a case and be extremely fair, you know, if a defense attorney refuses to, there's nothing I can do about that. I am never going to, I have not, and would not, and I can assure you my law firm wouldn't either. We are not going to settle a case below what we think we should settle it for just to get a quick settlement. It's never going to happen. If it takes us 1 year, 6 months, or 20 years to get a fair settlement, we're going to do that. Now, there are also times where, you know, settling a case earlier might be a benefit.
Certainly to the people who are going to get some money back from it. How do you weigh that? How do you weigh the principle of not settling against those who are clamoring at your door and calling you and screaming for a little bit of their money back?
What I tell them is, you know, the client is always the client. And we can talk about how somebody becomes a quote-unquote lead plaintiff in a
case.
Please
do.
But I can tell you this. We are lawyers like any other lawyer. And we represent a client. That client represents the class. And all I can do is inform the quote-unquote lead plaintiff of the facts. And those lead plaintiffs, either one or several, make the ultimate decision regarding settlement. Now, if
somebody not the whole group, but these few lead plaintiffs have to agree.
You know, it would be impossible for me to call or for me to take a tally of, you know, all tens of thousands
Correct.
Of shareholders in a particular company. So what the court does is they appoint a lead plaintiff. That lead plaintiff can be an individual or an entity, and it can be comprised of sometimes one or sometimes a group, depending on the court and the particular judge's view on the law. Basically, this is what occurs. When an initial lawsuit is filed, what we call the initial complaint, is filed. The Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, or the PSLRA, requires that law firm within 20 days to issue a press release. That press release tells the world, including all plaintiffs' attorneys and their clients and brokers, that a lawsuit has been filed. For example, I file a lawsuit today against ABC Corporation. At the same time, I issue a press release that says Cohen, Milstein, Housefield, and Toll, with offices in Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and even London, has filed a lawsuit against ABC Corporation. The lawsuit alleges violations of, for example, the Securities and Exchange Act or the Securities Act of 1933, and these are the basic facts. Any investor that would like to be a, quote, lead plaintiff in the action, please contact my law firm. Now, when my law firm receives what we call certifications back, we go through those. And, you know, some people have lost $20, some people have lost $0, and some people might have even lost millions of dollars. Just because you have purchased a stock for a higher price than you sold that stock for doesn't necessarily mean you have legal recognizable damages. The statute tells us exactly how to calculate a particular loss, or at least it helps us demonstrate how to calculate a loss. whoever suffered the largest loss can be, generally, the lead plaintiff if certain other factors are present. For example, in a case like Enron, it was going to be nearly impossible for a single individual investor to be the lead plaintiff, because an institution, for example, the California Public Retirement System, suffered such a tremendous loss, hundreds of millions of dollars. So in order for an individual to be a lead plaintiff, most likely, he or she would have to have a loss greater than that institution, assuming that institution was interested in moving for lead plaintiff. You know, in the Parmalat case, it's the same way. Because people's losses were so large, it really took institutional participation to run that case. Now, it's very important for both individuals and institutions to run these cases. If nobody steps forward, the case might not be able to move forward. You know, in a larger case, it's going to take a larger institution, you know, to run the case.
What if the institutions don't want to be part of it for whatever political reasons? Does that mean even the individuals who had major, major losses will not be able to
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay.
In the world of securities litigation, a loss is a loss, and a loss is generally what you look at. Now, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, again, the PSLRA, was designed to persuade institutions to get involved in these actions. But it doesn't say that in the statute. What the statute says is that the individual or entity that has, or the investor, that has the largest loss, typically, again, with assuming a few other criteria are present, can lead the litigation. So if, you know, Jason Levitin, you know, had a larger loss than the California Public Retirement System, it isn't necessarily the case that CalPERS would be able to lead that case.
Oh.
I would have just as much of a right to lead that case as anybody else. In the real world, however, an individual is almost never going to have the loss of an institution, especially in a very large case. Because an institution, you know, we think of institutions, and I don't think of them this way, but, you know, people can think of an institution as just kind of an entity. And that's true. The California Public Retirement System is an entity. The Arizona State Retirement System is an entity. But they actually are investing real individuals' money. And it's just hard to compare, you know, one person, you know, who might have suffered a large loss, and, you know, the Arizona Public Retirement System, who might have, you know, lost, you know, money on behalf of, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 individuals, or a heck of a lot more, you know, millions of people in a very large institution. So when you're looking at it, when I say institution, remember, an institution is generally made up of, you know, several hundred thousand, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of investors' money. So, you know, while each individual within the institution might have only lost, you know, 1% or 2% of their holdings, when you add all those up, if they represent, you know, tens of thousands of individuals, will generally outweigh the loss of a single individual, even if that single individual purchased 100% of their assets or, you know, of their money into the stock. Just in the pure numbers game, an institution is generally going to be larger.
And this argues for people to actually look for, to seek, to search out on the internet the law firm, and hopefully yours, that might be representing their particular interest in a case, and not to just, you know, cry into their loss. But maybe, you know, there's something that can happen, especially if it was a very large loss.
You know, there's many very good law firms out there. But I can tell you, my law firm is special, and we suggest people come to us for a couple reasons. First of all, we look at corporate governance reforms. As you pointed out, we don't necessarily make any additional money, you know, trying to implement a corporate governance reform. If I can settle a case for $15 million with, you know, two or three corporate governance measures, or if I could settle the same case for $20 million with no corporate governance measures, I would probably, in most circumstances, make more money by settling the case for $20 million. However, that's not the way we look at it. We look at protecting our clients and the class's interest. And if the class's interest, you know, makes us believe that a corporate governance reform is important, that's what we will do. The second reason I think that we are special, and again, you know, many of these law firms are great. I'm not going to put down any other law firm. But the other thing my law firm does is we have an international presence. You know, we believe that we work extremely well in the international world. We are the first plaintiffs firm to have an office in London, and we've prosecuted global frauds on more than one occasion. You know, we've prosecuted companies in England, in the Netherlands, in Europe. We currently have a case against a Chinese company. That is something that, you know, that you want to look at. You know, when you're looking at a law firm, you need to look at, are these lawyers, you know, specialists, or are they, you know, do they have the means to really litigate this case where the case is going to be litigated?
Must have fantastic background. You know, a variety of people that have come from very interesting, perhaps some from, I don't know, from the FBI or criminal law. I'm not sure, but it sounds to me like you've got a fascinating mix of people there.
You know, we have, in our Chicago office, for example, a partner in our Chicago office is a former Securities and Exchange Commission attorney. She is also the head of NASCAT. You know, we have a partner in the New York office who is a specialist in derivative and transaction cases. The head of the securities practice group, Stephen Toll of Cohen, Milstein, Housefield, and Toll, you know, has an accounting degree from Wharton. Mark Willis is an individual that has spent many years and many hours traveling overseas and speaking to foreign institutions. You know, we have associates. We have people at every level. We have Bernie Sharkman, who is a specialist in corporate governance reforms and has published several articles. We have, you know, a financial analyst looking at cases. We believe that diversity in our practice leads to the best results.
Well, the best results for the shareholders, that's to be sure.
I mean, that's the plan. You know, that's the goal. And we've been fortunate to be able to have that experience work with us. So for a particular case, it might make sense, you know, to have, you know, another one of our partners is a specialist in pharmaceutical litigation. So a case involving a pharmaceutical company, it might make sense for him to get involved. That's the way we staff cases. And presumably other law firms do the same thing. But I can only tell you what we do personally.
And
we are very proud of the lawyers that we have here, and we will put our lawyers against anybody else's without thinking twice. You know, we have gone up against, you know, the best defense attorneys in the country, and we have won. Just a couple years ago, we were actually able to bring a case all the way through trial. As you could imagine, cases are very expensive to litigate, and most cases are dismissed or they settle. But, you know, it's important to have a law firm that has brought a case to trial because sometimes, you know, if the company isn't looking to pay you what you believe is necessary to redress the harms done to the investors, you need a law firm that is ready to go to trial. And since the PSLRA was passed in 1995, there have been less than 20 cases brought to trial. And I can tell you that my law firm was in a position where we needed to be one of those law firms, and it worked out very well for us and the shareholders, obviously.
That's an amazing record. Jason, we have just another minute or two, and I wanted to mention some other cases that your law firm or you personally have been involved in. I believe you mentioned Sears Roebuck?
Yes.
Chicago Bridge and Iron?
Yep.
Just a word or two about them?
Okay. The Sears Roebuck case was a bonds case, and that case involved a class period back in 2001, and it basically alleged that the company had made incorrect disclosures regarding the creditworthiness of their credit card recipients. We were able to settle that case, again, through brilliant defense attorneys. You know, it's some of the best defense firms in the country. We were able to settle that case for $15.5 million.
Amazing.
We believe an extremely good result. Another case, Chicago Bridge and Iron. Again, extremely well-defended case. Some of the best lawyers I've ever worked with, to be quite honest with you. We were able to settle that case for $10.5 million, plus certain corporate governance reforms. You know, again, you know, these defendants don't admit wrongdoing. You know, the complaint, you can read for yourself if you would like to. You or anybody listening can certainly visit our website at www.cmht.com. That's Cohen, Milstein, Housefield, Toll, cmht.com, and read about any of these cases. And if you'd like any more information about these cases or any others, please visit our website and send me an email, and I can give you any more information that you might like. If you'd like to read a complaint in one of these cases, I would certainly be able to give that to you so that you can make your own understanding of what you think the allegations do and do not say. The nice part about a lawsuit is almost everything is public. The complaint is public. The defendant's motions to dismiss and their arguments against the complaint are public. Most of the settlement is public. And so what I would do, if somebody was really interested, is I would give them the documents so that they could see for themselves, you know, the complexities of these cases and how two very different individuals can have very different views. You know, I don't think defense attorneys are wrongly minded. I think they are giving their clients a vigorous defense and have some very legitimate arguments sometimes.
Well, Jason, this has been so interesting. We're going to have to sign off now, unfortunately, because I love it. I'm going to make the links to your law firm's website available on Rights Radio. People will be able to find it after the show and when we summarize the show and the highlights of the show, so they should return to Rights Radio if they don't find it from what you've just said. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show. And this is Dr. Joyce Starr signing off for RightsRadio.com and StarPublications.com. Again, thank you, Jason Levitan from Cohn Milstein, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.